Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Labyrinth in the News for Monday, January 18th, 2010. I'm your host, Christiana, coming to you live from the Couve. That's Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, Oregon, as I will be doing every Monday, normally at 3:30 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Today, due to scheduling problems, we are live at 1 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. My lead-in music is the first cut off of Susan Alexander's CD, Sequentia, called Ecos, which is short for icosahedron, the water symbol in sacred geometry. Sequentia is music using tones recorded from DNA vibrations. Susan recorded these tones in 1988 with the help of Dr. David Deamer, at the time a cell biologist at the Davis campus of the University of California. If any of you want to chat while we are on the air, please go to Christiana-Anea at blogtalkradio.com. Today, my guest is Cordelia Rose, a past Labyrinth Society workshop presenter, creator of Labyrinth, and yoga instructor. Let's get her on the air. Thank you, Cordelia, for joining me today.
My pleasure, Christiana. It's nice to hear your voice again.
Well, it's a beautiful sunny day here for the first time in weeks. We've been having nonstop rain. What's the weather like there?
Surprisingly, it's one of our few days of the year when we've got clouds and snow on the mountains. Usually it's bright blue sky, sun, heaven on earth.
Well, yeah, I can imagine. Let's first find out a bit about you, Cordelia. Can you tell us about your life in New York City and what compelled you to move permanently to southwestern New Mexico?
Well, I worked in Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum as a museum registrar since 1982. And we lived right by Times Square in Midtown Manhattan, surrounded by skyscrapers, and went on vacation at a friend's recommendation in New Mexico and went down to southwest New Mexico, right down here in the corner, because we were told it was very beautiful and nobody ever goes here and we'd love it. And it's very like the Kenya Rift Valley where we used to live before we came to America. So we came down here for vacation way back in the 70s and got off the plane in Albuquerque and thought, oh, we're home, and made a fantasy to retire here. So that's why we're here.
And tell us about the location of your ranch and your life there.
Well, we live on a high desert mesa. It's about almost 6,000 feet elevation. And we live right at the west entrance to the Gila Wilderness, which is 6.6 million acres of federal land, including the wilderness and roundabout it, which is a great deal bigger than a one-floor fire escape landing in New York City. And my life here is one of peace and quiet and no hustle and bustle from the traffic and things like that. I've got my horses. I've got my labyrinths. I teach yoga. I'm looking out of the window now, and I can see 70 miles to the south. Another window, I can see over into Arizona. And we just have a 360-degree view of absolute beauty.
Mm. I have had the great pleasure of being there, so, and I can attest to it being just a spectacularly beautiful place, and not what you picture. Now, Gila is pronounced Gila, but it's spelled G-I-L-A, correct?
That's correct.
The
yes.
Gila Wilderness, yeah.
And in fact, it's first wilderness that was designated as a wilderness in the United States, so it's a long time one.
I didn't know that. And so when and how did Labyrinth enter your life?
Well, I was still working in Manhattan and commuting out here after we bought the house and the land in 2000. And my sister-in-law, who's a weaver, Laura Nicholson, she sent me all the different colorways of ribbons she had designed with 12 of my brothers, Ben Nicholson's Labyrinth designs in the ribbon. And she just sent them to me because she thought, I work in a design museum and I'll love them. And of course I did. And we had just bought the house and I looked at them and I thought, perfect garden for New Mexico, doesn't need water. And there's lots of rocks. I didn't get Labyrinths at the time. I just came to them from a design point of view. And then when I first built my first one, it taught me the lesson of patience. And then I realized, oh, there's much more to Labyrinths than just beauty. So that's how they came into my life, just through a piece of ribbon.
And what design was that first labyrinth that you made?
It's one of Ben's designs, and it's a quadrant type of labyrinth with, it's about 60-foot diameter in the way that I've built it. And when he designed it for the ribbon, you just step into it anywhere and walk, but that was difficult for my horse, so we made an entrance and slightly changed it so it became an equine labyrinth, as well as a silver one.
Okay, so first I have a bunch more questions. You said that you lived in Kenya. Did
yes.
you learn to ride there?
No, I learned to ride when I was about 3 years old in England as a child. I used to ride the farmers' cart horses I was born during the Second World War. I used to ride the farmers' cart horses in to feed along with the dairy cattle. I just used to sit on the top of this big, big, big cart, brown, I remember he was brown, cart horse.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my the first horse.
And you grew up riding English saddle?
Yes, yes.
And in Kenya, did you ride there too?
I did. I trained polo ponies and I taught children how to ride all English. And I rode with my friends as well.
So you're a fairly accomplished rider and comfortable in that. And did you change to Western?
I did change to Western when I got here.
You did?
Yes.
And how do you like it?
I do. Well, it's very suited to the type of riding that I do because I ride trail up in the mountains and I've worked as an outfitter, as a wrangler, horse wrangler, mule wrangler for a outfitter. And we travel miles in the mountains on trails and a Western saddle is designed for that, whereas an English saddle is more designed for dressage and jumping and showing in general.
Hunting. And so you go for days at a time up in the mountains?
Have done, yes. Yes, when I've been taking groups out, assisting the outfitter. Yes, we go for anything up to 10 days.
What kind of horses do you use?
Well, I have Arabians, but generally quarter horses or what? We live 2 hours north of the Mexican border, and most of the horses around here come off Mexican ranches. They're absolutely bomb-proof, we call them. They can withstand anything, and they're tough.
And are they agile? I mean, because I'm leading up, obviously, to your work with horses on Labyrinth. So, I have this image of like, oh my golly, these horses are huge. But you just said that the first labyrinth you made was 60 feet. That's a big labyrinth.
It is.
To make the first time.
It is. I had no idea what I was doing, of course, and only ever having walked a labyrinth once in my life. And being a sort of camper, I decided, well, if you want to build a labyrinth, you need to figure out where it's going to be. And then I stuck a tent peg into the center of where I thought it would be. And I thought to myself, well, it's only one path, so you have to walk in and somebody else might be walking out, so it must be about two people's width. So I measured across two kitchen stools to get the path dimension, which turned out to be 30 inches center rock to center rock. And then I tied 30-inch knots in my washing line and stuck another tent peg way out at the other outside the labyrinth. And then I just kind of went around in pizza slices, laying rocks as I went, and by the time I got to the end, I had an extra circle, which confused me until I realized my washing line had stretched. And so I had to relay it, which taught me all about patience.
And you said it was a quadrant labyrinth. So did it have lattices? Does it have the double-sided axe figures to delineate the quadrants, or is it just a single line, single?
No, there's a north-south line and an east-west line, and then in between those, there are the curved pathways or delineators. So you walk curve, curve, curve pathway, and then you get swept around into the next quadrant and go walk curve, curve, curve there and get swept back again or to another quadrant.
And so how many circuits is it? What is it? How many circuits?
It was 11 to begin with. And then when I started riding my horse in it, we removed the center circles so that I could have more than one horse in there and turn around easily. So it's 10 circuits now. Not quite.
And well, 10 plus the center, so that's 11. So I guess, or is it 10 with the center included?
It's 10 with the center included.
Okay. And now you said that Ben, your brother, designed this. He designed it to model a medieval style labyrinth, or to model more of the Cretan, the classical, or?
No,
or
more of a medieval.
More of the medieval.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us about equine labyrinths. What are they and why?
Well, how did it happen? My brother happened to be staying with me because we were about to do a workshop, and I had ridden for the day in the mountains, and I and my horse were exhausted. And instead of riding around my labyrinth to get back to the barn and the paddock and everywhere, I just took a shortcut straight across the labyrinth, and my tired horse suddenly became very alert and picked up his feet as we rode straight across everything. And then I realized he was paying tremendous attention to me as I guided him and to his own self as he picked up his feet and followed the path. So I thought, ooh, wonderful training opportunity. And my brother at that time came running out of the house and said, you're doing something the Romans did. Nobody rides horses in labyrinths except the Romans and one other man, Ian Stevenson, in Germany. And so I thought, well, this is a great way to train a horse. Going around all the corners makes him very flexible. And he can't predict where I'm next going to go, so it's not habitual. And because I ride across the rocks as well as within the pathways between the rocks, so that he pays real attention to where he's placing his feet, especially when there's a line of six rocks to cross. And it calms him. He's a very high-spirited Arabian. And when we go into the labyrinth, he calms down. And if we've had a hot, fast ride out on the trail, then I'll walk him around the labyrinth to cool him off.
Mm. And do you always sit on him, or do you lead him sometimes by a rope, a halter?
The only time I've led him by halter rope is when I wish him to graze the grass so I don't have to weed whack the pathways.
Okay.
So he grazes. They both do. Both horses. I have two horses, or as many as I can hold in there, grazing. And then the other time that I lead him is if a visiting horse is coming and they're frightened of the labyrinth or nervous or not sure what to do, I will lead my horse in first so that they can be led by their owner and follow my horse, because they're great followers, horses, if they're not the leader.
Right. Now, you just mentioned that your brother talked about the Romans. You know, I didn't even know that. And I knew about equine. I mean, they actually are being used just now more. I know that the Labyrinth Society a couple of years ago had a tour on the a facility on the East Coast that had built equine labyrinth. Yes, in Baltimore. But I didn't know about the Romans doing this.
Well, apparently, they used to build labyrinths in the Colosseums. Oh, Ben, I wish Ben was here. He knows the facts correctly. I may be getting it slightly wrong. But they used to build labyrinths in the Colosseums to exercise their soldiers, because you can walk so far in such a small space. And the same with their horses.
Huh, I am going to have to look that up. That is very interesting.
You should definitely verify that, because I don't think I've just got it in my head because I like the idea. I think Ben told me that.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating bit of information, and for certainly. Now, tell me, though, you know, we all know, or many of us understand, those of us who work with labyrinths, how it helps people when they're walking. But you just mentioned that you sometimes have, not only do you use it, but you have other people come with their horses to use the labyrinth. Why did they come?
Well, for example, one person was training a four-year-old, and the horse simply would not turn to the left at all. It just would not go to the left. And it was frightened of absolutely everything. So I suggested to her that she bring it up to the labyrinth and see what happened. So she brought the horse up here and took him out of the trailer. And the first thing he did was bolt. So we caught him again. And then I led Blake, my horse, into the labyrinth. And he stood there shaking with fear, with his tail clamped down and staring eyes and tight ribs and everything. And eventually followed my horse in and sort of vaguely turned to the right and to the left, a bit confused and stumbly. And then we brought him out again, and we both got onto our horses, and I rode in again, and Wendy rode her horse in. And by the time we got to the middle, he was flexing to the left, he was flexing to the right, he was flexing beautifully to the left. But when we got to the center, it was lovely because he just stood there with next to my horse and let out a great big sigh and started licking his lips and raised his tail, and his ribs relaxed, and he just became a different creature and has been turning to the left ever since.
Mm. So, and what do you, and that wasn't probably the only story you have of because you've had other riders with their horses on your labyrinth.
Yes.
And what, I mean, all of this, all of these mannerisms, this change, what does that indicate? And what are the changes that you see, and why do you think this happened?
Well, labyrinths do have a power of their own, and if you're on a horse, you kind of feel as if you're grounding yourself through your horse's 4 feet as you're in the labyrinth, and I think that combination of horse and rider feeling grounded feels secure and calms the horse. And horses like following paths, so to follow the labyrinth's trail is something a horse likes to do, I think. And then now we're going to go here, now we're going to go there. It's not just same old, boring old ride that you might go on. Like you do in a school, you do all these, you go make a circle to the left, circle to the right, diagonal here, half vault there. This time you never know where you're going to go next. So the horse is kind of alert, I find.
So it helps, it teaches the horse to be attentive.
Yes, very much so. And the rider as well.
and the rider as well. So it improves, it actually improves the communication between the horse and the rider.
Oh, most definitely. And the other thing it helps to do with a rider is to help the rider give very precise aids. I've had learner riders in there who have, by the time they've finished, learnt to give very precise aids to help their horse go in the direction they want them to go in.
So in other words, what you're saying, if somebody has been a little sloppy, mm-hmm. and the horse has responded by getting tense and anxious because mm-hmm. they're not clear, this helps them both when they get in there. The rider to be less sloppy and more clear and crisp, and so then the horse relaxes because it has the clearer signals to follow.
Absolutely, yes.
And the whole idea of balancing the right and left hemispheres of the brain, now you have two brains mm-hmm. that are working in conjunction with that. So I guess that's probably true as well.
Yes. And we're beginning to work with places who have special needs children and adults come and ride horses as well. Near New Harmony, I went to a place called Riding Hope, and we talked with her about what the benefits of riding in a labyrinth could be, and the changing direction and the going around the corners really helps children with their balance who aren't perhaps able to walk, or confused children or adults. When they know that where they're going to go next, it helps with a sense of giving them a sense of direction.
I can see that because I know that they use horses with special needs kids, autistic,
yes.
all different. And I can see that. Now, would you want a simpler design for them? I mean, because your design is quite complicated.
And dangerous. Potentially dangerous, and it's made of rocks. We've built a three-circuit classic labyrinth for a place out in Indiana for them to experiment with. And we had 4-foot-wide pathways, which weren't quite wide enough, because you have to have a therapist on the left-hand side of the horse and a loving helper on the right-hand side of the horse to help the children not fall off, and then somebody leads the horse. So it needs very wide pathways and a big center. We have about a 10-foot center so that the horse and the people can all turn around and come out again.
And so what, you had to redo it? To make it wider?
Well, we've made, this has all been experimenting so far, and so we've made mm-hmm. temporary labyrinths making a little trench in the ground with a hoe and then pouring lime into it, because if anybody fell off or anything like that, not that they would because they're so carefully looked after, but you always have to manage the risk where a horse is concerned. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want anything like a rock anywhere near it. So mm-hmm. we just put lime in a trench so it's nice and white on the earth. And then you could mow a labyrinth. That would be a safe way. And I've mm-hmm. actually built a labyrinth out of horse manure here as an experiment to see how recyclable that would be. And it was easy to push the manure around to make wider paths if that's what I felt was necessary.
And you said that you have a couple of labyrinths at your ranch. Are they all horse rideable, or are they just that one mostly?
Well, since you visited, I've got one or two more than a couple. I have to tell
you. Oh, really?
I do have the one that you saw, the quadrant labyrinth, which is the equine labyrinth. And then I built the manure labyrinth, equine labyrinth. And I have a 7-circuit classic, which you would have seen, I think, when you were here, made of beautiful hand-sized rocks. And then
yes.
I have an interlocking spiral labyrinth, where you go in one path, round and round and round and round, through the center, two rocks, and out on the other path. And then since I think you were here, I laid the plan of a maze because I had Ben design it for me. It's so handy having a designer for a brother.
Mm-hmm.
And we put that down so that visitors who come here are always asking if they don't know about labyrinths. They're saying, well, what's the difference between a labyrinth and a maze? So I thought, better lay a maze so that people can feel the difference of being confused and lost and puzzled compared to the secure meditative walk of a labyrinth.
Well, you have, that, and that gets me to my next question. You have a labyrinth business, Whitewater Mesa Labyrinth. It's www.wmlabyrinths.com. And so what is the nature of your business? Do you, besides, I mean, you built other labyrinths on your property, and you just mentioned that you have built some other places.
I have. I've built labyrinths for a retreat center and a couple of private individuals. And I hold workshops and events here, like we celebrate World Labyrinth Day on the 1st of May, and Standing Women on Mother's Day, and what else do we do? World Healing Day we have at 5 o'clock in the morning on the 31st of December. It's an English-founded World Day, and they decided that at 12 noon Greenwich Mean Time, people around the world would walk a labyrinth and meditate on, or they don't necessarily have to walk a labyrinth, but I do meditate on world peace. But that's 5 o'clock in the morning here, so people come at 4:30 in the morning, and it's dark, and the stars are out. It's beautiful, and I light up my classic labyrinth, and that's what we walk.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, the stars are so close there, and they're so clear, and it's just, it is heavenly. It is heavenly.
Yes, you can reach out for the Milky Way almost.
Yeah. I checked out your labyrinth, your website, of course, and I was puzzled and very curious about a description in there. So I'm going to ask you, what is an, quote, ephemeral shuffle labyrinth?
That's fun. I dug 18 inches deep, a 40-foot diameter circle in the clay here, which is either mud or beautiful friable clay. And what I do is I've got labyrinth designs in my head now, and I lead a group of people in there, one behind each other, and I shuffle my feet in the clay, which is usually raked like a Zen garden. So I shuffle my feet in the clay, and I don't tell people what I'm doing. They just follow me faithfully, being careful not to step on the person in front, not to step out to the side and spoil the Zen garden. And so they follow me all the way into the center, and then we're all huddled up in the center, and I ask them to look out and see what they did, and they realize they've made their own labyrinths. And then the last person in leads out on the labyrinth path that they've created. So that's, well, you can do anything. I had some quilters here, and they made a quilt pattern in the shuffle labyrinth, which, fine. And my farrier's son, when he was 5 years old, he got labyrinths. He understood them. And he created this beautiful freehand labyrinth. So lots of things.
At 5 years old?
Little boy, he's very bright and very visual. Mm. And we walked each of my labyrinths while the horses were being shod. And then he asked what the shuffle was for. So I said, that's for you to make your own labyrinth. You can do what you like in there. So I left him to it. And then he came and got me and his father. And we walked his labyrinths.
Do you have pictures of all of this?
Have pictures of Clayton, the little boy, making his labyrinth. I just didn't like to photograph him and his father hand in hand. It just seemed such a private moment.
And what color is the clay?
It's kind of terracotta-y colored. Brown clay.
That's interesting. And do you use this is a specific ritual or ceremony that you use separate from some of these other events, or do you incorporate this into your events that you have?
Whenever I have enough people and they feel like doing it, outside workshops, I lead them in there. But we do, in our walks and talks workshop, which is a bigger affair, we always have a shuffle labyrinth walk in that. And then in the evening, when it's dark, we have a circle ceremony in the labyrinth. I light up the outside of the labyrinth, and so you can see just a little bit. And people bring their drums and their guitars and their flutes and their didgeridoos, and we have a circle ceremony. We smudge people as they come into the circle. And then we have a drumming, and that just goes on as past midnight, once it did. Mm. And we light a big campfire.
Lovely to drum up there.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
And so here, now this leads me to my next question. The dancing and the drumming, tell us about the maypole dance that you've created. And what kind of labyrinth do you use for it?
I use my Seven Circuit Classic labyrinth for that. We've made a hole in the middle of it, 3 foot deep hole, and put a pipe in it. So I can just slot my 21 foot maypole into it. It's a wooden maypole with a phallic tip and a wreath of red roses around the top, and a slot to thread all the ribbons through, and we just slot the wooden pole into the hole. And it was inspired really by the Danes, because they've been dancing the labyrinth with a maypole since the 70s, and I've been in contact with a man called Ole Jensen. Ola, not Ole. Ola, he told me. Jensen at Labyrinthia in Denmark. And he's been dancing around the maypole in a labyrinth for a while. And he helped me know what to do. And I made a model and worked out what my dance would be. Because doing it in a classic labyrinth, because there's a cross in the middle of it, you can't go round and round each other as you do in a traditional English and Danish maypole dance. You weave in a circle. So what we do is to go, we start off each with our ribbons on the outside of the labyrinth, and then I lead us in till we've walked one circuit, and then we weave backwards and forwards along that circuit so that we weave a piece of ribbon like a sail almost. Then we walk the labyrinth, each of us carrying a little bit of ribbon that's unwoven, and we kind of furl and unfurl the woven ribbon around the labyrinth as we walk the labyrinth pathway. And then we all get to the middle, and then we walk ourselves out again, and then we unwind. So we kind of make a dance with the unwind of the ribbons again.
Okay, so, now I have it. So what kind of wood do you use for the maple? Do you use a special, like a sacred wood that's like sacred to the Celts? It was ash or cedar or willow or...
Well, actually, it is a pine pole. I just asked the cabinet maker who lives in this amazing village of 350 people. There's always somebody who knows how to do something beautifully here. He went to the local timber mill and selected a pole and brought it back and carved it to my specs. And
is the groove where the ribbons go, is it lengthwise?
It's a slot. There's a slot right through the pole from one side to the other. And then I've got...
horizontally or vertically?
Well, it happens to be a vertical slot, but it goes...
Vertical slot, okay.
The pole is vertical. Imagine the pole being vertical and look up to the top and make a slot. Is that an American word? A slot. Make a hole in the top and thread the ribbons through so that you've got kind of 30 feet of ribbon either side of the hole. So they're long, long ribbons.
Okay.
8 long ribbons make 16 dances.
And they're tied with a knot in the slot?
I separate the ribbons in half, 4 and 4, and tie them with a knot either side of the slot. So they're tied on the outside of the pole. And so you've got 8 ribbons hanging down one side of the pole and 8 ribbons hanging down the other side of the pole.
Okay, I see. Now, you know, because I have to really visualize this in my
it's
mind.
Hard to
and
visualize, I know.
And are they, is the slot below the finial? You said it was a finial up on top.
Well,
and
you know that a maypole is danced on May Day, and it's very, it's boys and girls dancing. It's very definitely a springtime ritual. And so the maypole itself usually has a phallic, suggestive phallic top.
And
then the wreath of red roses around it represents the woman.
And so do
you
do this?
You want to be on the radio.
It's fine. Do you do this at the beginning of May, or Beltane? Or?
Well, it so happens that World Labyrinth Day is at the beginning of May, so we'll do it then. And I do it any other time that I've got enough people. When we were learning to do it, I brought all my yoga students up here and said, please help me figure out how to do this dance that I've figured out in a model, but I'm not for real.
And when do you use specific music every time, the same music or different music? Or?
We've had flute players. And in Denmark, Ola says that the best music is Irish jigs. So the workshop in New Harmony in November, we're going to have the New Harmony Musicians Guild play Irish jigs for us.
Well, I'm going to come to that in just a few minutes. I want to go back to, now you just mentioned you bring your yoga students to do this maypole dance. Have you ever taught them on a labyrinth before? Have you ever experienced that?
No, not specifically, but if visitors to the labyrinths don't really quite know what to do, it's because some people have never been to a labyrinth and they're a bit confused, and I sort of say this, you can't do anything wrong in a labyrinth, just do it. But they often need guidance, so I teach them simple pranayama, I teach them to breathe, or I teach them a mantra. There's a perfect mantra for walking a labyrinth, which is the one about universal truth, Sata Nama, where you touch your fingers to your thumb, Sata Nama. And you can do that in rhythm with your footsteps or your heartbeats or whatever is rhythmic. And so I do teach that, or there's another couple of mantras I'll give to people to walk the labyrinth with.
Gives
but I've
them
never
a good
actually,
start.
Mm-hmm. I've never actually held a yoga class specifically in the labyrinth. Although we've done a circle of trees, we've done tree pose with all of us holding onto each other's shoulders and putting our knees into the middle and out to the side and out to the back, like synchronized swimming.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Well,
it was
more for fun than particularly yogic, I must admit. But
did you feel any? Was there any feeling of did you experience anything from it energetically or
physically?
Well, I
think communal joy. Communal joy we experience, communal balance, or assisted balance, because we are holding on to each other. Synchronized movement. I'm searching here.
Yeah, I just was curious, because I have a canvas labyrinth, so I have very often done exercises, chakra work and attunements and things on the labyrinth, and was wondering, you know, and this would have to be more inside with a canvas labyrinth to do that kind of thing, but
well, you
just
could,
wondering what
you're saying. The weather's so glorious here, you could do it, but
that's true.
People would have to come up here, which is not so far from Glenwood. But I teach down at the community center in Glenwood.
Do you know what kind of labyrinth they use in Denmark for their maypole?
They have an 11 circuit classic that they use.
Okay, that's a big labyrinth then.
It is.
Because 11 circuit, yeah, that must be really big.
Yeah, a labyrinthia is a place of many different kinds of labyrinths, so you get the different experiences, water labyrinths and different designs of labyrinths. They've got many.
So your brother is Ben Nicholson. He is an architect?
Well, architects think he's an artist, and artists think he's an architect. so I think I have heard him called a conceptual architect, and he teaches at the Art Institute of Chicago, and he teaches a course not so much, I hope I'm getting this right and he's not listening, he teaches a course not that architecture students are going to pass their exams to build buildings so much as teaching a course to make architect students think outside the box.
Hmm.
So
well, I know I met him, and when I saw you at this year's gathering, Labyrinth Society Convention and Gathering, and you both have taken on the duties of creating the 2010 Labyrinth Society Convention and Gathering to be held in New Harmony, Indiana. And you just said that he teaches at Chicago Institute. Is that in Chicago, Illinois, or does he live in New Harmony?
In both, in fact. The Art Institute of Chicago is in Chicago, and he teaches there about 3 days a week. And his son, William, has an apartment in Chicago, and so Ben stays there with him, with William. And then he comes back down to New Harmony, where he and his wife, Laura, and daughter, Rose, live, and where Ben has his studio. So
and
he does a commute every week.
Okay, so that's why. Now, New Harmony is a very, very unique place.
Oh, absolutely.
It reminds me a little of Chautauqua, New York, but not sort of like, but not really, but sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of it because you mentioned this, the music. I know of it because of my interest in hammered dulcimers, and there's a huge traditional music community in that area connected with New Harmony. Why was this location, what did Labyrinth have to do with New Harmony?
Oh, well, a lot. the Harmonists, who were a utopian group originally from Germany, they settled in the early 19th century in New Harmony, or they built the town of New Harmony, and they built a labyrinth, which is called the Harmonist Labyrinth, and it's made of low hedges. So that's the first labyrinth that happened in New Harmony. And then some years...
When was that built? What was the date?
It must have been the early 19th century,
1820s
or something like that.
Wow, okay.
And then I think in the 90s, a beautiful pink granite Chartres-type labyrinth was built in New Harmony. They call it the Cathedral Labyrinth. And that's kind of looked after by historic New Harmony. And they have docents and they take walks and this and that and the other there. And then somebody who spoke at the gathering last year, Jim Buchanan, an English artist, is coming to be artist in residence in New Harmony just before and during this year's gathering. And he is going to be commissioned to build another labyrinth, I think a turn labyrinth.
Oh, how exciting.
Mm-hmm.
An exciting time. So what was the chicken and the horse here? Who decided, did Ben suggest, we're almost out of time, did Ben suggest this getting involved, or did you, both decide this is what you wanted to do together?
Well, when we've had workshops here, Ben has always said, oh, it'd be wonderful to have one in New Harmony, because there are labyrinths there. And then we said, well, why not suggest to TLS that they hold a gathering in New Harmony? And that's how that came about. And then I proposed the Maple pre-gathering workshop and the Equine Labyrinth pre-gathering workshop, because we knew we could pull it off there. And then those two suggestions were accepted, and then lo and behold, suddenly we're co-chairs of the gathering committee and figuring out what to do. So
well, Cordelia, I'm gonna have to cut you off, or we're completely out of time. But we'll get back to you with your brother as my guest sometime in late spring to talk much more about the 2010 TLS gathering. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
It's been wonderful, and many, many blessings on your path, and give a hug to your beautiful, beautiful Arabian for me, okay?
I will.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we're out of time. It is my intention to enlighten Labyrinth neophytes and support Labyrinth veterans with guests like Cordelia, who provide a depth of information and personal experience not available through other sources. I look forward to having them, both she and her brother, as my guests sometime in the spring. And you've been listening to Labyrinth in the News. So join me next week when my guests will be Eve Hogan, who has a business in Hawaii. She is an author and a motivational speaker and a Labyrinth consultant. And we will be talking about her work with Labyrinths and her spiral Labyrinth calendar, her spiral calendar, and what she does in Hawaii. So please join me next week for Eve Hogan's interview. And please have a blessed week, and take care of yourselves in Makesh.